Good morning. Well, this is an exciting day. We've got creative projects coming in. I can't wait to take a look at those. I suspect there are a lot more out there waiting to be done. So if you didn't turn in this time, don't forget that next deadline coming up in, 3 weeks or something. I'm not quite sure. And speaking of things coming up, don't forget that there is a homework assignment that's due again tomorrow at by 1:30. Email that in. Or hand it in to me. Email's kind of the easiest. And, don't forget, second quiz is coming up next Thursday, opening next Thursday, and I'll have more to talk to you about that next time, okay? But I will do a couple of those question-answer sessions again at the same time, so that was Wednesday at 12:30 and Thursday at 12:15. For those of you that have questions and so forth. So, second quiz coming up. Collecting more points. Fun. Okay. You know, one of these days... Oh, yeah, I did remember to turn it on. Good. So, let's see. More announcements. It being National Bologna Day, I think I won't give you any more of that right now. And we'll move into the lecture. So we are now moving from the bologna section to the non-bologna section. Okay.
What if we like bologna?
What's that?
What if we like bologna?
Well, I wasn't doing any value judgment on it at all. It's right up there with spam. I mean, no. And of course, some of you probably recognize the fact that I was playing Hawaiian music this morning. And I think spam must be the national meat of Hawaii. So, you know, it's like... What am I to say? The only kind of spam I get is in my email account, and that's usually not very tasty. Okay, so short of any other announcements that I can't think of right now, let's get going, because I got a lot I want to talk with you about today. Oh, I know. I knew there was something else. So for your lab homework this week, you were being asked to do yet another graph. Okay, and on the computer, and yet another kind of graph on the computer. So, what I would call a bar graph, of course, Microsoft doesn't call that a bar graph, it's called a cluster column graph, or something like that, a column graph. And I just really quickly created a little graph here to show you, if you didn't see this in lab, that's kind of what your graph should look like. Okay, so that's what the Microsoft cluster column graph looks like. So I chose, actually, I'm going to mess everything up here if I'm not careful. Ooh, it's not there. I chose, this is Excel 2010 for the PC. I chose that option. Oops, maybe I chose that option. Why do those look the same? One of those options, anyway. You don't want to, there's... Oh, those are color options, no big deal. There are lots of options that they give you that will give you really straight-looking graphs. You want just nice, clean bars like that. And there should be four bars, one for each stack. Get in there and label your actions and so forth. That's the sort of thing. Now, the data that I used, I just made them out of my head. So you're going to have, you know, your own specific data from your class. That's what the data table looked like. And to make that particular graph, I only selected this column. I didn't select both columns because it will try to graph both columns. I just selected this column and then told it to make the graph. And it said, yes, sir, I'll be glad to do that. And here's what I'll give you. And that's what I got. Now, this is kind of an ugly graph in my mind because I didn't have the time to change the font size. You know, that should be smaller font size so that you can get actually a bigger graph in here and it all self-adjusts. So I would encourage you. Oh, various. There's a new spelling for various. Oh, soaking in various sweats. Oh, well, it cut off part of my title there. But so anyway, you can tell I did that really quickly. But that's the sort of thing that we're looking for on that, okay? So that be the end of the announcement. So last time, we finished our look at the macromolecules, right? And we got to some of the, what I think are the more exciting macromolecules, the lipids, and especially because of some of the things that they do. We had talked about the basic building blocks, the hydrocarbons. We had talked about the acids that go to build up these larger things. We had talked about triglycerides, you know, the fats and the oils and that. And then last time we talked about the phospholipids. Right? And the phospholipids kind of being the key to biological organization in many ways. So we saw how the phospholipids are just a diglyceride. Right? So there's the example of a phospholipid, a diglyceride with this very, very polar group attached at the third spot. And then we tend to just kind of draw them out like that, kind of a schematic diagram of what it looks like with the very polar head end and the very nonpolar tail end. And we talked about how phospholipids will behave in a water environment, the different kinds of things that they would do, like forming the monolayers or the micelles, or most interestingly, those micelle bilayers, which form a model for the cell membrane. And we'll be coming back to that today a little bit later in the lecture. So that kind of completed kind of our quick look at the different macromolecules, right? And then we moved on looking at cells, a little bit about cell history of cell theory, different organization, the eukaryotic versus the prokaryotic. Of course, everything that we're looking at is going to be eukaryotic. Just about everything we're looking at is going to be eukaryotic. There was one term that I wanted to throw out to you, which is this here. When I was talking about the blue-green bacteria, the blue-green algae, whatever you want to call them, really I failed to give you kind of the proper name for those, which is down here. It is sometimes even referred to as cyanobacteria. Cyan being blue, so there's that blue cyanobacteria. Those are just kind of interchangeable terms. Blue-green algae being kind of the oldest term, then blue-green bacteria, and then cyanobacteria. So you might see them represented any number of different ways. So those were some examples of those different things. And then we began looking at measurement, right? And the fact that these cells are all small. Prokaryotes tend to be a whole lot smaller than eukaryotic cells, but they're all small, so how do we measure this? We were talking about how the standard unit that we use is the micron, which is 1/1,000,000 of a meter. We looked at the meter stick. We talked about taking that meter and taking it all the way to Portland, right? Stretching it out all the way to Portland. And if we were at that scale, what would things look like? And the small bacterial cell was on this level, right? Kind of the medium-sized dog, whatever, missing its legs, head, tail, and so forth. And the kind of the typical eukaryotic cell would be this lecture hall, right? So in contrast, again, size, tiny, on that large scale, tinier, much tinier. And then this little red dot here, little pinkish red dot, being kind of a typical virus, so even much, much tinier. But that, it's okay. I mean, the size of the virus, you really can't do very much, but then viruses aren't alive anyway. They're non-living infectious particles. They get into the cell, they take over the cell's machinery for doing things, they make the cell do what they want it to do, and that's how we get more virus particles and how they destroy cells and so forth. So we looked at that. We were looking at microscopes at the end, the light microscope versus the electron microscope. We saw that with the light microscope, practical magnification up to 1,500, maybe 2,000 times at most with really good optics, and the fact that that was limited by that resolving power that we talked about. So how close can two things be together? And you can look at them, you can magnify them, and you can still see that they're two things rather than thinking they're just a single thing. How close can they be together? And that was the resolving power. And we saw that with the light microscope, it's about 0.2 microns, which is pretty small. But that limits the amount of magnification. We might magnify something to 3,000 powers of magnification, think, wow, we've got to figure we can see more. You can't see any more information because you're limited by the resolving power. So you're not going to see, you may see things bigger, but you're still not going to get more information from that. So light microscope, and that was the limitation, was the wavelength of light, what we're using to illuminate with. So then we moved to the electron microscope, much, 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 much shorter wavelength, get much higher magnifications, much better resolving power. So we started talking about the scanning electron microscope, which some of the newer ones now, if you want to pay enough money, you can get up to 500,000 magnifications with a resolving power now of 0.4 nanometers, and nanometers a thousandth of a micron. Right?
so really, really small. So that would be 0.0004 microns. If as long as things are farther apart with scanning EM, farther apart than 0.0004 microns, you could actually see that there were two things there rather than one. So that gives us a lot more information. Now remember, there are some limitations. There's limitations to all of these things. With the light microscope, you can actually look at live things and so forth. You see them kind of in their natural state. Although lots of times we'll look at prepared specimens that are on microscope slides. With the electron microscopes, you're always looking at something that's not only dead, but it's been dried down. It's been completely dehydrated. All the water's been taken out. The water absorbs electrons and so forth. And you tend to look at specimens in a vacuum. So if there were water in it, the water would be pulled out into the vacuum and kind of mess up your pump. So dehydrated, so you worry a little bit, you know, if I'm drying this down, what artifacts am I putting into this? How is it changing the structure? Is it changing the structure? So that's always a concern, though with the technologies we've got today, they're pretty darn good. We're pretty confident of the structures that we're seeing. Although that could change tomorrow. You know, a new technology could come along and we could have better techniques for preserving things and looking at them, and we could say, oh, look at this, really, that was an artifact that we were looking at. This is what it really looks like. So that's always an issue with science as new technology comes along. We feel pretty good about the images we're seeing today. So scanning EM, remember, it's just looking at surfaces, outer surfaces, inner surfaces. If you've broken something open, you cannot look into something with a scanning electron microscope. Like with the light microscope in lab, you looked at, this week you're looking at the LED cells, right? You look right through them. You can look in them. You can see the chloroplasts in them. You can see other things. Well, not a whole lot, but you see in the LED, because a lot of it's kind of translucent, like the vacuole. You see where it is just by where everything else isn't. But you can see into them. With the scanning electron microscope, because of the way the specimens are prepared, the fact that we're drying them down, we're coating them with a thin layer of gold, and then shining a beam of electrons and scanning back and forth, we're capturing the scattered electrons and creating an image from that, you're only looking at surfaces. So you've got to keep that in mind. Like I said, outer surfaces, or you can take a cell and maybe break it open and look at the surfaces of parts of the cell and so forth, but you're not looking in through cells. So that's a scanning electron microscope. And then the third kind of microscope, actually the second kind of electron microscope that I wanted to talk with you about, is what we call the transmission electron microscope. An electron microscope, oftentimes you'll just see abbreviated EM, okay, because people get tired of writing out electron microscope all the time. So you see transmission EM, and actually transmission will get abbreviated as T. So if you see an image, and maybe in the legend for that image or something, it says TEM, that means it was taken with a transmission electron microscope. Or SEM would mean it was taken with a scanning electron microscope. So that things get really abbreviated down there. Now, the transmission electron microscope, I think, kind of gives you an idea of what's going on here. Like the scanning EM, we were scanning with a beam and we're capturing electrons that were either being reflected off the surface or being stimulated to be sent off the surface. With a transmission electron microscope, we're actually going to send a beam of electrons right through that sample. So with the transmission electron microscope, we are going to be looking at the insides of things. Now, there are some real limitations, though, and again, you have to dry your sample down to get all of the water out of it. Generally, then, that sample will be embedded in some sort of a plastic resin or something. Typically, you'll take capsules, like you would get a medication in, and put your resin in there, put your sample in there, put the capsule together, let it dry, and then you have to make very, very, very thin slices of the specimen that you're going to look at. Because if it gets too thick, it's going to absorb all the electrons, and that's going to be the end of it. Okay, so we're using very thin specimens, much thinner than anything you saw in lab. Now, when we looked at the onion root tips in lab, those were thin sections of the root tip also, so you weren't seeing the whole cell there. And that's why they tend to give us on those slides three different root tips, because those are what we call serial sections, one section, then the next, then the next, and you can kind of go back and forth because the sections may be so thin that you don't get everything in the section, so you go back and forth. With the transmission electron microscope, your sections are much, much thinner, less than a micron in thickness. And there's a real talent just to getting those thin sections, being able to cut them on a device we call a microtome. Good microtomes use diamond blades on them, and you're just making these little, very, very thin sections. And you're laying them onto a grid. Okay, so you'll capture your little sections, you'll lay them onto a grid, and that's what you're going to put them into the transmission electron microscope on, a little mesh grid. Now, the electrons, most of transmission electron microscopy, you can't just look at the specimen. Okay, you're not going to get very good contrast or anything. So the specimens get stained. And they tend to get stained, so to speak. It's like you use the blue stain in lab to enhance the contrast of your cheek cells. So we would do that with the transmission electron microscope, but there we're using heavy metals, typically, to stain them. And so you wind up with an image, you're shining this electron beam, a concentrated electron beam, through your material, and your image is really being created by the heavy metals. Where have the heavy metals been attracted to? What have they stuck to? And they tend to be hydrophilic, so they tend to be stuck onto surfaces that are hydrophilic surfaces and so forth. But eventually, you're gonna get an image. Now, we can't see electrons, right? So there are two ways, typically, where one of these will form an image. One is that underneath the specimen, so kind of like your microscope, only the electron source is coming from the top rather than the bottom. Okay, you're going to shine that through your specimen. You have a little mirror under your specimen, and it's going to shine that up into a phosphorescent screen. Now, those of you know, before the day of LED TVs and things like that, the old CRT picture tubes that you might have had on a computer monitor or your TV at home, those are phosphorescent screens. And the way you get an image is a beam of electrons being shined on that screen, and that creates the image that you're watching. So the same thing happens here. So you will have a little phosphorescent screen that beam of electrons gets bounced into, and we can look and see the image then that's been formed by that beam of electrons going through the material. So that's one way of, that's really not capturing the image so much. If you want to capture the image, we can just put a sheet of film underneath the stage, and those electrons will expose to film. And so typically you use glass plates with photographic emulsion on them, put them underneath, capture the image that way, develop the image, and now you've got an image that you can print and so forth. Anyway, that's just a little insight into how this technology works. It's not like I'm ever going to ask you about that, but you think it's important to kind of have some feeling for what's going on. Now, the transmission electron microscope, they've come a long, long, long ways over the years in development. And right now, the really expensive, the really high, what we call high energy, because they're using high voltages on them, the high energy electron and transmission electron microscopes are giving us upwards of 50 million magnifications. 50 million times. You think, oh, that's at least 10 times greater than the scanning electron microscope. Actually, 100 times greater, right, than the scanning electron microscope. So much greater magnification, but what's really important? Resolving power, right? So the resolving power for these really high energy electron microscopes is about 0.05 nanometers, which equals, if I can get the right number of zeros here, 0.00005 microns. Really small. So as long as two things are at least 0.00005 microns apart, then you're going to be able to see that they're separate, that they're not the same thing, that they're separate items. Yeah, making sure I got the right number of zeros in there.
So, high magnification, high resolution, we can, and in fact, with some of the high-energy electron microscopes that are being developed now, you can actually begin to see molecules. And that's been the dream. You know, everything that we know about molecules has been kind of circumstantial evidence. We have different ways of kind of figuring out, like, what does a DNA molecule look like? Well, there are different ways of kind of figuring that out and putting that together. And now we're to the point where we can begin actually imaging those molecules. And remember the excitement when some of those first images came out. Lo and behold, that molecule looked like what we thought it should look like based on this other evidence. So people have been doing good work in that area. Now, before we go to the next page, I would like to spend a little bit of time and show you what some of these images... Yeah, question.
That beam this time is going right through the specimen. So it's going through the specimen, and that's why you've got to get all the water out, because if there were any water in there, it would destroy the specimen, because they would absorb the electron beam. It's going right, kind of like the light microscope, except you're using electrons, and it's much more complicated, because it's in a big cylinder, you have to get all the air out, and all this kind of stuff. So that's the sort of thing that we could do in biology class, but yeah, that's what we're doing. Yeah.
Oh, 3B, that's where, you see the contents inside of a cell. You're looking in, and you really just see parts of that too, because the magnification is so high. You might remember when we were fiddling with the light microscopes at first, if you looked at that letter E, the higher the magnification, at our highest magnification, it wasn't even E anymore, it was just parts of an E. And so as you go up in magnification, you're just seeing progressively a smaller and smaller part of that which you're looking at. So we're looking inside cells, we're looking at structures inside cells. We're really just looking at parts of those structures, perhaps, depending on the magnification. You can control the magnification on these. With the transmission electron microscope, you control it by the voltage you're applying to the electron beam and stuff. So you can control that magnification to a certain extent, just like the light microscope. Okay, let's look at some images.
So you see the difference there. There are very recognizable differences between the different kinds of microscopes. Okay, come to me, image.
So, last time, remember we looked at these images.
And we were looking at kind of comparing the complexity of the bacterial cells to the complexity of the eukaryotic cells. Well, those are all actually the transmission electron microscope images. But let me come back to that a little bit later. So, first of all, what do we see with the light microscope? So these are very typical kinds of images that you can develop with a light microscope. Happen to be human eggs and sperm. Okay, so typically, your upper left corner, you're looking at sperm. You can see the guy going across the middle's got two tails. I don't know why he thinks he's so good he can have two tails, but that happens sometimes. The one at the bottom, you can see the egg with the sperm all around it. And so forth. That's the kind of detail that you can see. Or the two on the left, or on the right, those are both images of eggs, and they tend to have a zone of cells around them and so forth that the sperm have to penetrate through before they can fertilize the egg. Typical light microscope images. We point out there that even with the light microscope, there are different ways of illuminating things that kind of give you different images. Like, for example, this one in the upper left, where it's got that little halo of light around it, is what we call phase contrast microscopy. And that there's a certain way of illuminating that, and it tends to highlight structures. It makes it easier to see the long tails, the flagellum, and it makes it a little bit easier to see what might be inside. Now, the microscopes that you're using in lab are just what we would call bright field. You've just got the light and you're controlling the amount of light. Although the microscope that we have off to the side that your instructor may be using is a phase contrast microscope. And we can set that up for bright field or we can set it up for phase. And they may, hopefully, when you were looking at the euglena maybe in that lab or some of the protozoans, they may set it up for phase because you can see the flagella so much better and so forth. So different ways of illuminating that give us these kinds of images. And remember, you can look at live material as well as preserved material on the light microscope. Let me go back here. If you look at the surfaces and you think, oh, well, especially these two on the right, they look like pretty smooth surfaces and so forth. That's what we can see. Now, we go up in magnification. These two images are with the scanning electron microscope. Okay, so we're much higher magnification. And again, we're just looking at the surface. And a couple of things that you can note. First of all, the surface isn't nearly as smooth as you might have thought it was. Right? Because now we can start to see some of that detail, that mesh-like network, or a bunch of little rays to fulfill it. The good news is the sperm themselves are pretty much the same shape. That's what we saw in the light microscope in terms of shape, although we magnified them a little bit more here. And you can see that that's the shape. So that gives us some confidence that what we're seeing with this scanning electron microscope image is truly reflects what's going on in nature. But that's the sort of thing you're going to see with the scanning electron microscope surfaces. If you look in the newspaper that they love to print every so often, you'll see the head of a fly or the foot of a fly or this or that. That's a high magnification image. Almost always those are going to be scanning electron microscope images that you're seeing there that shows the close-up of this creature. You think, oh my gosh, there's no way in the world I would let that in my house, and then you probably got it living on you and you don't know it. We don't need to go into that right now. But that's what you're going to get with the scanning electron microscope. So high magnification views of the surfaces. So you can see a lot of detail on the surface. You're probably looking at the scanning EM. And one last thing about this, you notice the coloration on the one on the lower right. That's all artificial. The electron microscope images that you get are all strictly black and white. Now, sometimes people will colorize them to kind of pull up different details and so forth. Anytime you see a picture like that with color, that's been added. That's an interpretation of the person that either created the image or is working with the image to highlight certain things. Now, this is a transmission electron microscope. You say, okay, well, what does that sperm head really look like? So we can take it up in magnification and start looking. Now, again, remember, very, very thin section. And so we're not even seeing the whole head. So there is the head. It looks like there's something going on in here. So we call that the midpiece. There's the long flagellum tail. But, of course, it goes way off the image here. It's not on here. So that's kind of a low magnification transmission electron microscope. There's a higher magnification image there. So there's the head, and the nucleus is up in here. Nucleus is really dense here. You're not really seeing much detail. But there's that mid-piece region down here. You can see it a whole lot better. And you start to recognize the fact that those are all mitochondria. And we'll talk about the structure of mitochondria later on, so you don't need to worry about that now. But they're very easy to pick out. They have a particular structure to them. And then these long tubular-like structures are actually called microtubules. They're made out of protein. They're going to run the whole length of that tail, and it's the movement of them against each other that actually allows that flagellum to move back and forth and provide propulsion. It's the mitochondria that are metabolizing sugars and transforming energy to allow that the flagella to actually be able to move. Without those mitochondria, the flagellum would run out of energy really quickly, and that would be the end of that sperm. So this is just a part of the head, a little part of the tail. This is probably from another adjacent sperm there. So high magnification looking into the cell, seeing what the parts inside the cell look like as opposed to the outside, And then this is an even higher magnification image. If we were to take this region down here, this tail where these tubules are, and cut that, and then look at it on end, that's what we're seeing. So each one of these represents one of those flagella, the tubules, and we know that there's an arrangement that's called a 9+2 arrangement here of those microtubules, that they move against each other, and that's what gives them the motion. Okay, so we can see that with the transmission electron microscope. There's no way in the world that we can see that with the scanning electron microscope. Don't even try with the light microscope. You know, you just don't have not only enough magnification, but you don't have enough resolving power to see anything like that. So here's an example. Here's a light microscope image of what kind of cell is that?
Cheek cell.
Cheek cell, right. And it's been stained with methylene blue, so you kind of got the blue. What do you see with the light microscope? Well, there's the nucleus. You can see the cell membrane, not because the cell membrane is so thick, but because it's kind of, if you can imagine a sheet of paper, if you look at a sheet of paper on edge, if you were to be able to hold that sheet of paper absolutely flat, you really wouldn't be seeing very much. But if you were just to hold a sheet of paper up on edge, you'd say, oh yeah, I can see it because it's not flat, right? And so you're seeing the various convolutions of it and so forth. And so we're seeing the same thing here with this cheek cell. You know, you say, oh, I see all sorts of stuff in there, but I don't know what that stuff is, right? Just kind of the granular cytoplasm. And that's pretty much what you can see in a cheek cell with the light microscope. We go to the electron microscope. You can look in there and you see all sorts more detail. So there's the nucleus, there's the nucleolus that we talked about in that lab. There are various membranous structures that we'll be talking about later on today. There are some mitochondria scattered around. We can see all that with the transmission electron microscope. That things that we couldn't even begin to see with the other kinds of imaging. And to look a little bit more, so here's a kind of a typical animal cell that's dividing. Okay, there are chromosomes there. It's just about finished dividing into two cells. That's what it would look like in the light microscope. This is what it would look like in the scanning electron microscope. So again, we're just seeing the outside surface here. We see that surface isn't nearly as smooth as it looks to be in here, but we can't see anything inside. We don't know what's going on inside. All we can do is look at the surfaces. And then with the transmission electron microscope, we can really zoom in and look at some of the fine detail of the chromosomes all lined up, the little tubules that are going to pull the chromosomes apart, centrioles. All of these components become visible to us with the transmission electron microscope, things we couldn't see any other way. So those are the different kinds of images that you might see with the different kinds of microscopes that we have. I don't want to go there.
Okay. So if I were to show you an image, hopefully you would be able to recognize it based on what we've looked at. And if you look in your book, you'll see a variety of these kinds of images in the book also. You would be able to at least be able to distinguish and say, oh, that looks like it's been taken with the light microscope or the scanning electron microscope or the transmission electron microscope by the kind of detail that you're seeing and so forth. You kind of identify it that way. And magnification helps also. Okay, any questions about that? Well, let's start talking about how the cell is constructed then. What goes into constructing the cell? What are the different parts of the cell and whatnot? Some of that you did in lab last week. Part of it you didn't because we don't have the tools in lab to do it. So over on page 24, the first thing I wanted to talk with you about is the cell membrane. The cell membrane is absolutely critical to the life of the cell. This is an important point to remember, because sometimes people get confused. Every living cell has a cell membrane around it. Every living cell has a cell membrane around it. And that cell membrane is going to distinguish between that living inside and the non-living outside.
And the cell's going to use that cell membrane to control what can come into the cell and what can go out of the cell. Okay, so every living cell has a cell membrane. Now, sometimes people get confused that with the cell wall. Lots of different organisms like plants and fungi, the protozoans and so forth, they also have a cell wall. We'll talk more, we'll look at the cell wall a little bit later. The cell wall is always on the outside. The cell membrane is always on the inside of the cell wall. But not all cells have a cell wall. For example, animal cells, our cells don't have a cell wall. Therefore, they can be more flexible, more pliable. We can move around like we do and so forth. Because we don't have a hard cell wall on the outside that's kind of determining what the shape of our cells looks like. So not all, so a lot of cells have a cell wall, and it's very useful to them in terms of forming structure or keeping them from exploding in different aquatic environments and so forth. So that's really useful. But not all have that. So animal cells certainly don't. But all living cells have a cell membrane. So whether you're looking at cells that have a cell wall or not, they're going to have a cell membrane. If they've got a cell wall, that cell membrane is on the inside of that cell wall. So kind of file that away. So let's take a look at the cell membrane, first of all, and see how that's put together, because it's such an important part of the cell. So there, number one, the cell membrane separates the living inside from the non-living outside. When people first started trying to figure out, well, what's that cell membrane composed of? The chemists got involved. And what are the chemists going to do? They're going to collect up cell membrane. And you can do that pretty easily. You can take red blood cells. And for those of you, most of you have been to lab this week, you know that water will move osmotically. And if a red blood cell is hypertonic, the water will move into that cell. If it's hypertonic to the solution surrounding it, water will move in. And if you get enough difference in the osmotic pressure between the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell, you can cause those cells to burst right open because there is no cell wall around them. In fact, it's at about half the osmotic pressure of the cell. The osmotic pressure of a red blood cell is about the equivalent of 1.8% sucrose solution. It's not 1.8% sucrose in there, it's just all these other things in there that would be the equivalent osmotic pressure of 1.8% sucrose. So if you were to put red blood cells into fresh water, say, okay, 0% sucrose, it wouldn't be long before those cells would take up so much water that they'd all burst open. And people took advantage of that. They made what they called red blood cell ghosts. Okay, a red blood cell ghost is just a red blood cell that's been exploded, and you collect up the membrane separate from and throw away the contents. We're not worried about that right now. The membranes are the red blood cell ghosts. So they could take those, get a whole test tube full of these things, and chemically analyze them. You know, what's this made up of? And what they were finding as they were doing this was that they're primarily constructed of proteins and phospholipids. Plus a small amount of carbohydrate. And with the proteins, just an incredible array. They weren't really concerned about what the actual proteins were at the time, just proteins. The phospholipids, I should include, plus other lipids. Because we'll see in a minute, the cholesterol is a very, very important component of cell membranes. So cholesterol, that gets all the bad attention anymore. Boy, if you can just rid your body of cholesterol and you can live forever. Mm-mm. You need cholesterol for your cell membranes to make them function properly. Yeah, question. Oh, osmotic pressure is a term that's used to describe how readily water will move into another solution. Okay, so if the water, how best to describe this, the higher the concentration of chlorine, the higher the concentration of solute in the solution, the greater will be the osmotic pressure. the lower the concentration, the less will be a zone one threshold. Okay? And that reflects the concentration of particles, which in kind of a backwards way reflects the concentration of water. Because if you've got more particles in solution, you've got less water. And if you've got fewer particles, you've got more water. Water's always going to move from where there's more water to where there's less. Okay, so that, but that's what I'm searching is.
And you'll see that term come up in the final time. So for example, a 1.8% sucrose solution will have greater osmotic pressure than say a 0.5% sucrose solution, which has fewer particles. Okay, proteins, phospholipids plus other lipids, and then carbohydrates. So people thought, well, that's interesting. How does this all fit together? How does this work? Because we know the phospholipids, you know, lipids tend to be a very hydrophobic group, right? We know the phospholipids are amphipathic. We know the proteins tend to be hydrophilic, although there are some, depending on the amino acids that they're composed of, that might be more nonpolar because of a higher concentration of nonpolar amino acids. So here's what people were working with.
They would take a transmissional electron microscope picture of red blood cells. Now this is magnified only 360,000 times. So for transmissional electron microscopes right now,
that's really hardly any magnification. But in its day, when that picture was made, that was cutting edge.
Cutting edge magnification. So this is a red blood cell. And we're only seeing a little piece of that red blood cell. A lot of granular cytoplasm over here. We're too worried about that. But then here's the non-living outside, here's the living inside, here's the cell membrane. And not only in red blood cells would the cell membrane kind of look like, I want to say railroad tracks, but there are no tie, cross ties, right? Just two rails. And that's a very typical image of what we see for membranes, whether it's inside the cell or cell membrane surrounding the cell. We would get an image like that and try to figure out, what does that mean? A dark line, a clear in the middle, and another dark line. What in the world does that mean?
Based on, so here's one dark line, here's the other dark line with clear in the middle. Based on the fact now that we know it's really about half protein and half phospholipids, something like that, and that composition changes a little bit depending on the species or depending on where we pull the membrane from, but you know, it's composed of those things. Well, so initially people were looking at this and they're scratching their heads, they're saying, well, you know, the stains that we're using, heavy metal stains that we're using, are really hydrophilic stains. They're attracted to hydrophilic areas. So, and the proteins, in this day and age, the proteins haven't really been examined carefully and so forth. Well, we know proteins tend to be dissolved in water. So they're hydrophilic. We know that the lipids are hydrophobic. Therefore, the best interpretation was that this membrane, the image that they were seeing was kind of like a phospholipid sandwich. Okay, and they said, okay, it looks like maybe the lipids are inside here because it's not being stained. The region in there is not being stained. And the protein must be then coating the outside. So if you can imagine a phospholipid sandwich with the bread being the protein, that was kind of the early interpretation of what was going on. As often happens in science, that proved to be wrong. Okay, totally wrong, but that was, you know, you're trying to figure out what's going on here, and as things progressed, it became apparent that that's not at all the case. The protein isn't all on the two outer surfaces with all the lipid in the middle. That, in fact, that membrane is more like the micelle bilayer that we looked at earlier. Remember what the micelle bilayer looked like? We've got our phospholipids with their polar heads pointing both out and in. Like that, right? So this was the very hydrophobic region, the area in the middle. This was the very polar region on either side of that. So the heads of the phospholipids were actually what were attracting the stains, and that's what they were seeing. So we know now that that's a much better model. That's very, very likely what's going on there. So it's a phospholipid bilayer. What about the protein now? Okay. Well, we got to account for that. And it turns out that the protein is interspersed throughout that bilayer.
So you have that drawing there in the lecture notes. Here's our phospholipid bilayer. Okay, the polar head of the phospholipid in this drawing has been drawn in this little yellow balls. And then the two tails, the fatty acid tails, are like little strings. I kind of think of them as yellow balloons with two strings or something. And they're forming this bilayer with all the tails on the inside with the heads towards the outside. And then the proteins are interspersed. A lot of proteins we find will extend clear through that bilayer from polar zone out here to very non-polar zone in here to polar zone out here. Some proteins would just be inserted in one side or the other. This would be the outside of the cell up here and the inside down here. So some are on one side or the other. Some proteins have carbohydrate attached to them, but that's only on the outside. Okay, we find sugars attached to the proteins. The sugars are only pointing to the outside, not to the inside. And then sometimes those sugars are attached to phospholipids, also or other lipids that might be in the membrane. So it's not nearly as simple as people originally tried to interpret it, but it really is a pretty elegant way of putting a membrane together. Phospholipid bilayer with proteins inserted throughout. And there are many different proteins now that we know that we find in the cell membrane in different orientations and stuff. Those proteins are doing different things. And we'll talk about what a few of those things might be in just a few minutes. Now, you might ask, well, how can it be that a protein can sit in this hydrophobic zone? So we're talking about how proteins tend to be hydrophilic in nature. And people have taken some of these proteins and they've analyzed it. And especially, not just knowing the sequence of amino acids, but doing work to visualize the actual shape. You know, it all comes back to shape again. And we know now that these proteins that are embedded, or they're embedded down into the phospholipid bilayer like that, they have a lot of the amino acids that are interacting with this, they're non-polar amino acids. And that's how they can sit within this area, because they're presenting a non-polar front to the bilayer. That's where they're going to not have to interact with water. That's where they're going to embed themselves. And then we look at these regions that are either on the outside or the inside, and lo and behold, a lot more polar amino acids there to allow them to interact with the water. So it all kind of fits together now in terms of what that membrane looks like. The term that's used to describe that model is called the fluid mosaic model. Fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. Nothing else is called the fluid mosaic model, so if we were talking about the fluid mosaic model, you really don't have to say a membrane structure. Okay, fluid mosaic model. Now, why did they give it the crazy name? Fluid mosaic. Well, let's talk about fluid first. What does that mean? You look at a membrane like that and you think, wow, is that just really static? Is it like plastic or something? Or is there something else going on? And in fact, there's something else going on. Membranes have to have a level of what we call fluidity.
In order to function properly,
they can't be just fossilized, locked in place. They have to be fluid. And that fluidity has a couple of consequences. One is that these phospholipids and other lipids that this is composed of can move laterally within this membrane. I mean, this one over here may be here right now, and if we had a way of tagging it and coming back a little while later and finding the same spot, we may find this move over to here, or it's moved over to here. So they're able to move around within this membrane. They're not just locked in. cholesterol molecules. Remember I told you we need cholesterol. And so cholesterol is inserted in and amongst these things. And one of the things that the cholesterol may be doing is helping to maintain the proper fluidity of that membrane so that it can do what it needs to do. We know that, say, for example, cells and organisms that live in really cold weather. Okay, as it gets colder and colder, that membrane is going to become less and less fluid just because the temperature is going down. But the cells have to maintain a certain level of fluidity, so what do? They adjust the kinds of phospholipids, the amount of cholesterol and so forth in the membrane, so that it will maintain enough fluidity so that they can do what they need to do. So if we were to look at the membranes of cells from, say, the Arctic and compare them to cells from Ashland, we see that the membrane, the composition will be different because they're needing to maintain that fluidity. And a similar thing, if we were to go to, say, Yellowstone National Park and get some of the bacteria or algae that live in the hot springs, I mean, it can be like 90 degrees Celsius in those hot springs. I mean, if you fall in, there are stories of people that have fallen into those and they get cooked. I mean, it's that hot. But there are things that live in there all the time. How do they do it? Well, one of the ways they do it is by controlling the fluidity of the membrane. So again, as it gets warmer and warmer, we'd expect that membrane to get warmer and fluid. Well, that's not. And so they have a different assortment of phospholipids and other lipids and cholesterol that will make them less fluid under those very hot conditions so that they can maintain a certain level of fluidity that allows them to be functional. So that's the whole idea behind fluidity here. So it's very fluid. These proteins, unless they're anchored, sometimes the proteins are actually anchored on the inside with other proteins, but if they're not, these proteins can drift around within that whole matrix of that possible fly there too. Move from one place to the next, kind of randomly, one place to the next to the next. So it's a very, very fluid environment. But that fluidity level has to be carefully monitored and maintained. If it gets too fluid, it's not going to work. If it gets not fluid enough, it's not going to work. There's some interesting research that was done a long time ago, and I never heard where it went. But some people were doing some research on alcohol. You know, and why does alcohol make the nervous system malfunction? In other words, people get drunk. Why is that? And one of the approaches that they were looking at is whether alcohol was affecting the fluidity of the membranes in the central nervous system, nerve cells. To see, I never heard where that research went, but it kind of gives you a little insight into the importance of having the proper fluidity, because if you start messing that up, then your cells are going to start to malfunction. They're not going to function the way that they should. And for nerve cells, that may not be a very good thing, actually, for any kind of cells. So fluid, mosaic, where did that come from? Well, this is certainly a mosaic. Not only are there probably hundreds of different proteins that we might find inserted in that cell membrane, hundreds of different proteins, some of which are going to be receptors for hormones, others are going to be helping to move things through the membrane, others are going to be doing other kinds of things, hundreds of different proteins, but there's a mixture of lipids that go to form that membrane too. So that's where the idea of mosaicness comes from. The whole membrane is a mosaic of components that fit together and function together. So the fluid mosaic model is what we've been working with for a long time now in our understanding of what the membrane, how the membrane is composed. And actually people early on, when they were trying to figure out what does some of those proteins in the membrane do, they would isolate and purify the protein, and then they'd put them into micelle bilayers. So they could create micelle bilayers, the proteins would insert themselves, and look and say, okay, what is that protein doing in that kind of isolated environment? So we kind of come back to that basic model that we talked about. Okay, so that's how we understand the cell membrane and any other membrane that we talk about in the cell to be constructed. Questions about that? Yeah?
Why do they look like yellow?
Yellow balls?
Yeah.
Are they? Oh,
So if you look, each yellow ball has two little strings attached to it. Those are the fatty acid tails.
So it's the same thing as I've drawn here.
I'm sorry? Cholesterol is not possible. It's a lipid. It's hydrophobic.
It's a whole different molecule on its own.
Okay.
And the way they've drawn it always kind of looks to me like a tadpole or something. But that kind of reflects the actual shape. I'm sorry?
The little reddish ones?
Yeah. So.
So yeah, these guys are all cholesterol molecules in here. Those are the phospholipids. These are the proteins and so forth.
Yeah.
So different cells, yeah, different cells in different areas will have different compositions, and it's especially noticeable if you go from really different temperature regimes. Really cold, intermediate, really hot. You'll see quite a different. I mean, they'll be constructed the same. You'll see a real difference in the components that are constructing so that they can maintain the fluidity that they need in order to function well. They may vary the amount of cholesterol. They may vary the actual nature of the phospholipids, different fatty acids and phospholipids and so forth. Any number of things that they can do in order to maintain. And that's all coming from information in the nucleus. That's all the information all in the nucleus. So there's feedback in there to make sure the fluidity is maintained.
Okay, let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk with you about how do we move things across that membrane. Okay, so let's get back to the membrane now. And we've talked about this idea of fluidity and components and so forth. And now, the last thing I really want to point out to you is remember my cell bilayer, polar on both sides, but very, very non-polar in the middle. So the next thing we need to talk about is how does a cell move things across that membrane. We had that little exercise that you did last time where we made some micelle bilayers, put salt on the outside, said would the inside be different from the outside, and the answer was yes it would, because the salt can't get through that hydrophobic barrier. Well, it turns out that most of the things that the cell's going to want to move in or move out are hydrophilic things. So how do we make that happen? So let's talk real quickly about how things move in general at the cellular level. And that's something that you're dealing with this week in lab, at least in part. So there's some processes that you need to really familiarize yourself with coming out of lab or if you've still got lab to go to. One is the idea of diffusion. Okay, things at the molecular level move by diffusion. Diffusion is the result of the fact that molecules are always in motion. So the only place they're not going to be in motion is at absolute zero. And no matter how the physicists try to hit absolute zero, they have not gotten there yet. Although they're incredibly, incredibly close to that. At absolute zero, presumably all motion would stop. But anything above that, you're going to have motion. And the warmer it is, the greater that motion is going to be. And so, like here at room temperature, and this, we're so far away from absolute zero, it's not funny, lots of molecular motion, and molecules will move by diffusion, which is simply the movement of molecules from where they're more concentrated to where they're less concentrated. Okay, the movement of molecules from where they're more concentrated to where they're less concentrated. Purely a physical phenomenon. And this difference in concentration is what we call the diffusion gradient. The diffusion gradient, because if there's just a little difference between the more concentrated and the less concentrated, this process will happen a lot slower than if there's a large difference. So the larger the diffusion gradient, which would mean the bigger the difference between the more and the less concentrated, the larger the diffusion gradient, the more rapidly this process is going to happen. These molecules are going to move. So again, it's purely a physical phenomenon that goes on in life around us. Now, in lab, you're looking at a process called osmosis. Lab, you're looking at whatever that was that I wrote there, osmosis. And osmosis is really just a special case of diffusion. Okay, one way to define it is the diffusion of water. Well, this is kind of a biological take on osmosis. Diffusion of water across a semi-permeable or selectively permeable membrane. A diffusion of water across a semipermeable or selectively permeable membrane. Semipermeable means that this membrane has holes in it, and if you're small enough to fit through the hole, you go through the hole. If you're too big to go through the hole, you can't go through it at all. So semipermeable is based just on the size of the holes in the membrane and how big you are. So again, if you're small enough to fit through, you go through as if the membrane wasn't there. If you're too big to fit through, it's as if the holes aren't there. You're stuck on one side or the other. That's the idea behind a semipermeable membrane, and that's what we've been modeling in lab this week, is a semipermeable membrane. On the other hand, a selectively permeable membrane is basically what the cell membrane is. And the cell membrane doesn't move things so much based on their size as their chemical nature. And so that's the idea of selection, the membrane itself, the components of the membrane, select what can move into that cell, what can move out of that cell. And there may be two incredibly closely related molecules. Only one of them can move across, the other one can't. So this selection can be very, very specific indeed. Okay, selectively permeable, that's our cell membrane. So that's water. Well, how does water do that? I mean, we've got this really thick hydrophobic layer that the water has to get through. How in the world does the water move through that hydrophobic zone?
In general, if we're kind of maybe generalize this a little bit more, if we're looking at hydrophobic substances, if there were hydrophobic substances and somehow available in the cell, they'll dissolve right into this membrane because it's a hydrophobic membrane. Hydrophobic substances have no trouble getting into the membrane, and then they're just a step from either side going out or going into the cell. Things like DDT are hydrophobic substances. They get absorbed into membranes. They create all sorts of habits from that point of view. So that would be an example there. But hydrophilic things, like I said, hydrophilic things are mostly what we want to move across that membrane. How do we make it happen? So what's going on? Oh, I should add real quick from lab, make sure you understand these terms that you're going to be getting: hypertonic, hypotonic, and isotonic. So make sure you understand what those terms are and how they're defined and so forth. And the other thing that I want you to be able to do from lab especially is if we were to take, say,
a beaker of some sort of a solution and put red blood cells in them, based on the contents of the cell versus the contents of the beaker, I would like for you to be able to tell me if that cell's going to take on water and grow larger, whether it's going to shrink down because it's losing water, is it going to stay the same, whatever. Those are all concepts that are dealt with in lab. So make sure that you pay careful attention to that. And if you're having trouble with that coming out of lab, you can visit your lab instructor or visit me, and I'll be glad to. It's a pretty straightforward concept. Yeah.
Hydrophobic, it will dissolve into the membrane. And then there are other means by which they may actually get run into the cell. But they, hydrophobic substances, have no problem getting into the membrane. And half the trouble is just getting into the membrane. So hydrophilic things
don't dissolve into that membrane. So water is an example. Sugars, amino acids, ions, all of these different things that we need to move maybe in and out of cells, into or out of cells. We need to have some way of doing that. Well, water has been a puzzle for a long time because water moves so freely back and forth across the cell membrane. You say, well, how can that be? You know, what's going on? And that puzzle was solved a few years ago when people working really on an entirely different problem realize that there are proteins in the cell membrane that are hollow, as it were. They're proteins that stick clear across the membrane, and they're hollow in the middle. And that hollow in the middle is a hydrophilic surface through which water can pass. So we call these channels.
So for water, there are these channels that are made of protein that extend across. And you've got a drawing there on page 25 of what one of those channels might look like. It's almost like a, you know, a spool that thread comes on or something. You put that in, and then you've got this little opening in the middle that something can pass through. These proteins were originally named aquaporins. Aquaporins, they were originally found, well, actually, I'm not going to go into the story. Anyway, when they were originally discovered, actually, the person that discovered them actually got a Nobel Prize for this. They were discovered in one system, and now we know that there are lots of different aquaporins that are used by different kinds of cells to allow water to move back and forth. And there are certain diseases, if you use that term, that people have that relate to the inability to move enough water across the membrane because maybe they're not making enough of the particular kind of aquaporin that they need, or maybe they're making too much, they're moving too much water. So there are different defects that can arise by problems with the production of the aquaporins and the different kinds of cells. But we now know there's this whole category of aquaporins that allow water to very, very freely move back and forth across the membrane. And water's going to move according to its diffusion gradient. So it's going to move from where there's more water to where there's less water. If there's more water inside the cell than outside, it's going to move out. If there's more water outside the cell than inside, it's going to move in. So osmosis, that process of osmosis, will take place there. It turns out that there are other proteins that act as channels for ions. So there are other proteins, and they tend to be quite specific for the ion. And in fact, some of them are kind of interesting because they open and close. Under certain conditions, they'll be open. The ion can flow maybe back and forth across that channel freely. It'll flow according to its diffusion gradient. In other conditions, that channel may close down. And actually, that forms the basis for nervous activity. We talk about nervous impulses. Nervous impulse is nothing more than a synchronized opening and closing of a couple of ion channels and letting the ions flow back and forth across that membrane. Okay, so in some cases it's like that. In other cases, there are proteins that actively will move ions to one side of the membrane or another. But let me come back to those in a minute. Okay, so channels for water, channels for ions, we find in the cell membranes. Really important things. Well, that works fine for the little guys, so to speak. Water's small. The ions tend to be fairly small. What about the bigger things? What about sugars? What about amino acids and so forth? There are no channels that are big enough to allow a sugar to move through. That's just way too big. And so what we find in the membrane to move some of these bigger things through is some of these other proteins that are embedded within the membrane that recognize, they have a binding site where a particular sugar might bind to the protein, and when it's bound, that protein is going to change shape, and as it changes shape, it moves that sugar, say, from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. So it just kind of carries it through that hydrophobic zone.
And in your lecture note packet, this is carrier-mediated transport. So the carriers are proteins that we find in the membrane, and there are all sorts of different ones. The cell, the DNA, controls what carriers might be in the membrane. And this is where you might have two sugars that are almost identical, but because the carriers are so specific, if you've only got a carrier for one of those two sugars in your membrane, you're only going to be moving one of those sugars across the membrane. The other sugar is going to be stuck on one side or the other. It's not going to be able to move across. You need to have carriers for these things. So we talk about carrier-mediated transport, and you have an example there of one idea of how carriers might work, and this seems to be the one that's kind of winning out in a number of circumstances in one form or another. It kind of appears like that. So we've got this protein that's embedded in the membrane. It's got a very, very specific shape, which will mimic a shape by a molecule. So here I've got what looks like a bicarbonate sugar, say. And when the appropriate molecule comes along and binds with the pocket, so there will be some sort of a pocket in the protein to which that will bind. When that happens, then the protein changes its shape, kind of like a trapdoor. That's why this is called the trapdoor model. Okay, imagine somebody standing on stage on top of the trapdoor, somebody pulls the lever, and what happens? They drop through the trapdoor. Right? Well, in this case, the molecule binds on the one side, the protein changes shape, and lets it out on the other side in one way or another. So it's kind of, that's the trapdoor model. And it gets that substance through that hydrophobic zone into another hydrophilic zone.
So carrier-mediated transport is really important for things like the amino acids and the sugars, the simple sugars, and so forth. That's how we're moving them back and forth. Again, you've got to have the carrier in your membrane in order to make that happen. If you don't have the carrier, it's not going to happen. And that is the cause of a variety of different kinds of problems that people might have when they don't have the proper carriers in the membrane. Now, as we talk about carriers in proteins in the membrane, we talk about them, there are two different distinct categories of carriers. And you'll see them there on in the middle of page 26. Okay, there are ones that we call, that result in what we call facilitated, that should be a T. Facilitated transport. And with facilitated transport, the carrier doesn't care which way that molecule is traveling. Okay? As long as it's going to travel according to its diffusion gradient. So that molecule, if there's more of it on the inside than the outside, it's going to be deposited to the outside. If there's more of it on the outside than the inside, it's going to be deposited to the inside. So strictly according to the diffusion gradient. And a good example of that is carriers for glucose. Glucose is, when you talk about blood sugar, we're talking about glucose in the blood. After a meal, you tend to have an elevated level of blood sugar in your blood. Well,
the blood going from your gut where digestion's happening, where you're absorbing all these nutrients, it goes before going back and circulating around the body, it goes to the liver. And the cells of the liver have carriers for glucose in the membrane. And as long as the level of glucose in the blood is higher than the level of glucose in the cell, that glucose then will move into the liver cells, and the liver cells are going to store that away as glycogen. So by building the glycogen molecules, they're constantly keeping the level of glucose in the cell down so they can store away more and more glucose. A while after the meal, though, that blood glucose level is going to start to drop, and when it gets to the point where there's less glucose in the blood than in the liver cells, that glucose is now going to start moving back out of the liver cells to supply glucose to the rest of the body. And as it does that, it'll start to break down that glycogen that you've stored away to continue supplying glucose. So that's an example of facilitated transport where the molecule is going to move according to its diffusion gradient. It doesn't take anything else to do that other than having the carrier there. So facilitated molecules move with diffusion gradient. That's facilitated. Now, the other kind that you see there is what we call active transport. And this is quite different from facilitated because in the case of active transport, the molecules move against the diffusion gradient. Against the diffusion gradient. What that means is that if there's already a high level of something inside the cell, that's higher inside the cell than outside the cell, with active transport, you're going to bring more of that in. So you're going to build that stockpile up even higher inside the cell than outside the cell, or vice versa. Now, a good example of that is in the case of nerve cells. Sodium and potassium are the two ions that are critically important that make the nervous impulse happen. We tend to accumulate potassium on the inside of the cell. So if you were to look at a nerve cell, you'd find that the level of potassium inside is much higher than outside. And we have an active carrier that is bringing that in. And by the same token, we tend to exclude sodium outside the cell. And so we wind up with a much higher level of sodium outside than inside. In order to do that, in order to move something against its diffusion gradient, you have to supply energy. So it needs energy because you're moving things in the opposite direction of where they would normally move. So a keynote of active transport, not only is it moving things against the gradient, but you've got to supply energy to make that happen. Okay, so I'll leave you with that and see you all Tuesday. Have a great weekend.